Dear brethren and sisters, those of you who still have volume one with you might like to turn back to that opening chart which is found just in front of page one. And we'll see the breakdown which we've used in setting out what we consider to be the natural divisions of the apocalypse. And this is the reason why our chairman has said that we are in fact coming to what we have styled the second section. You notice how we've picked out the phrases such as, after this I looked, after these things I saw, after this I beheld, and such phrases. And we believe this indicates the natural divisions of the book. Well, chapter 4, verse 1 brings us to the beginning of this second section, because we notice in the opening verse that it says, after this I looked and beheld. So we'll say a little bit more about this natural division in just a moment. But this is then the indication that the vision is now changing. John is now seeing something different, and we are going to be now taken into the events of the future. So we can close up volume one for the time being, although we may want to keep bringing it along with us, because sometimes in the notes we refer back to volume one on some of the themes. Now, let's have a look at the introduction to volume two. We're going to follow our notes fairly closely this evening, and I'll read out this introduction here because I think this really covers what I want to say, and then we'll look more specifically at some of these points that we're going to bring out in these opening verses. The notes are a continuation of the study of Revelation which was commenced in volume one, and in case anybody doesn't have volume one, we tell them what the title is, Hear What the Spirit Saith to the Ecclesias. I think it might be opportune at this stage to just issue a word of thanks to the excellent job that Maynard and Arthur have done in producing this second volume, I think equally as well as the first. And they put a lot of effort into it, and I think we're all very pleased with the presentation which we've got before us here. So it is the second then in this series. The previous notes, as we know, covered Revelation chapters 1 to 3, and this is the important part, because John had presented before him, in the first three chapters, details of the existing conditions in the seven ecclesias of Asia when the trumpet voice at its first sounding revealed to him the Lord's view of, and notice we've got it in inverted commas, the things which are. So you see the three chapters, chapters 1, 2 and 3, were introduced by that trumpet voice. Remember back in chapter 1 and verse 10, John heard the voice of a trumpet. He says, I was in spirit on the Lord's day and I heard behind me a great voice as of a trumpet. And he turned to see that voice. So there was John, he heard the trumpet voice, and he turned to see it. And so in looking behind him, there he was in spirit on the day of Yahweh, there he was on the day of the Lord, the day of God manifestation, when the Lord shall return, and he looks behind him, and he sees events which are in the past. This is the symbology of Revelation. So the trumpet voice introduced this particular vision. So John in spirit looks behind him and he sees in effect coming up towards him this whole series of events which the apocalypse outlines. So the first trumpet voice in chapters 1 to 3 spoke of the things which are, that is, of the conditions which existed in John's time in those seven ecclesias in Asia, with of course the extended exhortations which we've looked at. Now, this next section, as we go on to say, this current volume opens with the same trumpet voice calling to John again. So this is the second sounding of that trumpet voice. The first time it sounded, it told John to listen and to look at things which existed at that time. Now when the trumpet voice sounds the second time, John is told to come and see the things which must be hereafter. Notice the difference. Now, those who've perhaps already had a glance through the notes will notice that two or three pages over, we say quite a bit about these trumpets. And we draw the comparison between the sounding of the two trumpets back in the law of Moses, found in Leviticus 22 and 23 and 24 and 25. So here then is an interesting start. The trumpet voice in the first three chapters spoke about the things which existed at that time. This trumpet voice now says to John, come and see the things which must be hereafter. Now we put that in the introduction because it is important. We go on to say that emphasis is once again laid on the apocalyptic theme of God manifestation. I'm going to keep repeating that and repeating it. We must never lose sight of it, and particularly in this section we're looking at in chapters 4 and 5. And in chapters 4 and 5 we are presented with an inspiring vision of the redeemed saints rejoicing in the triumph of the Lamb and extolling his virtues to the assembled multitudes. It speaks of the time when Yahweh shall be king over all the earth. In that day there shall be one Yahweh and his name one. That's the ultimate of God manifestation. In keeping with this theme, therefore, it is fitting that the Lord Jesus Christ is described by various symbols appropriate to the particular aspect of God manifestation being dealt with. Thus, he is the one sitting on the throne in chapter 5, verse 1. He's the lion of the tribe of Judah of verse 5. And he's also the lamb of verse 6. The saints are likewise depicted in various facets of their work of God manifestation. They're the four living ones of chapter 4, verse 6. The 24 elders of chapter 4, verses 4 and 10. And also the redeemed of chapter 5, verse 9. It is vitally important to recognize this principle in order to appreciate the message of the book as a whole. One individual or group of individuals may be described by several different symbols appropriate to the feature of the work being considered. Now, whilst you say, yes, okay, I know that, you've told us that many times before, you don't have to repeat it. I'm afraid we do, because I find myself, in reading this through, coming across a symbol and saying, right, that symbol is such and such a person, or such and such an emperor, or such and such a nation. And in the next verse I find another symbol and I say, well, I wonder who this is. It's got to be somebody else. It doesn't have to be somebody else. It's not so much concerned with individuals and nations and persons as it is in respect to a manifestation of God. So that if the Lord Jesus Christ performed several different works, one of which can be described as a lion, one of which can be described as a lamb, and another one of which can be described as a king sitting on a throne, then they can all be the same person, but in a different aspect of God manifestation. You may not see the problem that I do. I see a problem in as much as it is possible to have a wrong understanding of the book of Revelation because one does not appreciate this. And let me state once, and I will not repeat this anymore, that Revelation chapter 4 is the point at which you go wrong, if you're going to go wrong. If you're going to go off on the wrong tangent, then you're going to go wrong at this point here in Revelation chapter 4. And there are views around which start to deviate at this point. It's not my job to tell you what those views are. I only want to tell you what I believe is the correct view. But God manifestation is the theme. If we've grasped this, then we've got the foundation for the rest of the book which flows out of it. It's a very bad policy for a speaker ever to say that something he's going to deal with at a certain time is going to be difficult. So I won't. But let me say this, that the early verses of chapter 4 are the most important, really, for laying a basis in Revelation, and we may have to spend a fair bit of time on them. Let's put it that way. We may have to spend a bit of time on them, but we want to do that because having laid the foundation there and seen this aspect of God manifestation, the rest will, I believe, flow out of it very, very simply. So we conclude our introduction by simply saying that the sixth chapter contains a description of the opening of the first six seals of the scroll, which is referred to in chapter 5, and it depicts the judgments of God being poured out on the pagan Roman Empire and the way being prepared for Constantine to establish Christianity as the officially endorsed state religion. Well, I don't think we need to say any more about the seals at this stage. They'll come up in due course when, God willing, we get to chapter 6. But we're going to be looking now at chapters 4 and 5. Now, these are part and parcel of one vision, and they are, as we've said, a very important part of our study. To try and get a mental picture of what John actually saw, I selected the words of Brother Roberts from 13 Lectures, which you'll find on the opening page of our notes, which happens to be page 45, because our last book finished on page 44, so we're continuing the numbers through. So on page 45, we've got this very picturesque description which Brother Roberts gives to us in his book 13 Lectures on the Apocalypse, and I think we'll read this as well. He says, the first three chapters deal with the affairs of the Friends of Christ as organized in separate communities in various parts of the world. Christ in these gives his opinion or judgment of the condition and deportment of these various communities and advice according to their needs in such a way as to be beneficial to all his friends afterwards. He now turns John's attention to the future. I will show thee things which must be hereafter. John, thus addressed, finds himself in the Spirit, and a spectator of the scene which becomes visible to him as a result of being in that state. The picture is a very gorgeous one. It is a picture of overpowering glory and loveliness, symbolic though it be. Nothing more sublime and beautiful could be conceived than the brilliant scene that burst upon his view. A human figure of dazzling brightness sits on a shining throne, overarched by a rainbow of glowing colours. Before the throne, stretching away on all sides, an outspread ocean of glassy splendour and crystalline translucency, on which are grouped before the throne strange but glorious objects, four curiously formed living creatures, glistening all over with eyes, and 24 venerable men wearing crowns. Surrounding them on all sides is a countless multitude of the angelic host, forming an outer fringe of glory. John watches and listens. He sees movements and hears voices among the living symbols. The elders do homage to the central figure, casting down their crowns. The four beasts are instinct with life and give forth sounds of praise. The angelic environment take up the anthem, and the vault of heaven rings with the joyous and melodious outpouring of glorious myriads. The most superficial consideration of the picture would suggest that the kingdom of God is here symbolized. This view becomes certain when we look at certain details. And so that gives us a general picture of what we're going to be looking at. Now for the detail. As with all of these things, when one starts to get into detail, sometimes one loses the overall picture. So let's try and retain the overall picture while we're still looking at the details. We've got to try and do three things here. We've got to try and retain the overall picture. We've got to look at the details. And as we're looking at the details, we also want to see what the lessons are and what the exhortation is. Now, the exhortations have been very obvious to us over the last 7 weeks. That's been quite obvious. The exhortation is equally powerful in this section, but we have to draw it out. And it may not always be there in every single point. We may have to wait a few verses to see the connection. But the exhortation comes in a different way. The exhortation was obvious in chapters 2 and 3 because it spelled it out in plain, straightforward language, interspersed by one or two symbols. Now it is entirely symbolic, and the exhortation will only be meaningful inasmuch as we understand the symbols. So that the symbols are written that the person who has developed a mind of the Spirit, a mind which is in tune with the Word of God, will be able to automatically translate those symbols into literal language and extract the exhortation. Now this is going to be easier for some people than for others. You know, as I stand here and look around, I realise that there are people here that have been baptised a matter of days, and there are people here who have been in the truth for tens of years. How familiar is the average person with the symbols of the book of Revelation? Well, I think it's only fair, brethren and sisters, that we assume that the average person is not familiar with the symbols of the book of Revelation. Those who are, well, I trust you'll bear with me, and you just won't go away and saying, well, all that stuff was too simple tonight, we heard it all before. Bear in mind that we want to cater for everybody, and therefore we're going to assume that you know nothing. Well, very little anyway, and certainly we're not going to assume anything as far as the understanding of these symbols. Well, that was a fairly long preamble. Let's go straight into it then. You might like to have your notes open on page 47, because I will be covering the matter there and occasionally referring to it. Verse 1 then tells us that John, after these things, looked and beheld a door open in heaven. We've mentioned several times that this is one of the key phrases which John uses to indicate a new phase of the apocalyptic vision. The Authorized Version simply says here, after this I looked. But it should be more correctly rendered, after these things. That is, after the things which were outlined in those first three chapters. So John had previously seen the things which existed, styled the things which are. Now he's going to witness the things which shall be hereafter. And so the door was opened in heaven, and that first voice which he heard, which as it were of a trumpet talking with him, said, "Come up hither, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter." Well, let's first of all look at this phrase, "A door was opened in heaven." First of all, we'll go to our notes, and then we'll comment on it after we've read the note. John in vision saw a door opened in the heaven, symbolical of the place of political power. We'll prove that in just a moment. Our attention is restricted to a door, that is to one door. Now, understanding then that the apocalyptic heaven is that constitution of things, expanded over all peoples, nations and languages, as the government by which they are regulated and controlled, the door therefore represents a means of entrance by which a new power will ascend into the political heavens. So we are saying then that the phrase heaven here is not referring to literal heaven, but it's used in a symbolic sense of political powers. In the next paragraph we'll prove that particular point. But just for the moment, we'll take our word for that. Therefore, a door in heaven must symbolise an entrance into the political powers, an entrance into these new heavens, these new political heavens. Their period of probation having been accomplished, that of course was chapters 1, 2 and 3 of Revelation, the saints are now prepared to manifest the glory of God as rulers in the kingdom age. Christ is the door. John chapter 10 and verse 9 tells us that. He has already entered into his rest, and he has, as we were told in the earlier chapter, the keys of hell and of death. He will raise the dead, and he will open the door into the kingdom. For those who may like to trace this word out a little further, you might like to compare other uses of the word door, such as a door of faith in Acts chapter 14 verse 27, and a great door in 1 Corinthians 16 verse 9 and 2 Corinthians 2 verse 12. So if the heavens then indicate the kingdom age, the political system of the future age, then a door in that heaven must indicate an entrance into that kingdom. So you see, John looked and he saw the door there. And then the voice calls to him and says, "Come up hither, ascend up here, and I will show you that which must be hereafter." We comment firstly on this word heaven. And we state that heaven is frequently used as a symbol of ruling powers. Let's look up some of these examples. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 1. In this chapter we have the words of Moses. Moses speaks to the people of Israel. And he uses the language of poetry and the language of symbology. Very difficult to actually distinguish between these two things on many occasions. If one was to say, what's the difference between poetic language and symbolic language in the Bible? Maybe there isn't a difference on occasions. Certainly, Moses is using the word of song here, because we're told in the 30th verse, the last verse of the previous chapter, that Moses spake in the ears of the congregation of Israel the words of this song, until they were ended. And so, the song, or the poetry which he used is, "Give ear, O ye heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth." And he's speaking these words to the congregation of Israel. He's addressing Israel, and the context of this chapter tells us he is speaking to Israel. And as he speaks to them, he addresses them as, "O ye heavens, and O earth." He was speaking to the rulers of this particular constitution of things as the heavens. He was speaking to the people at large as the earth. And the symbol of heavens and earth become very prominent symbols found in the book of Revelation. Currently I'm preparing notes on Revelation chapter 11. So, a fair bit ahead. And in that particular chapter you've got two gods. You've got a god of heaven and you've got a god of the earth. They're two different gods altogether. The heaven is one thing, the earth is another thing. They're two different systems. The symbols become quite important. And so here Moses is speaking to the heavens and to the earth. He's speaking to the whole of the nation of Israel, both to the rulers and to the ruled. Isaiah takes up the same theme in Isaiah chapter 1 and at verse 2. And he again speaks to Israel. "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for Yahweh hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knoweth his owner, and the ass his master's crib, but Israel doth not know, my people doth not consider. Now he wasn't just talking to the heavens and the earth. He was talking to people. And in this symbolic, poetic language, he uses the terms heavens and earth. To be more specific, certain nations are specified as having certain heavens. Whilst we're in Isaiah, we turn over to Isaiah chapter 34. We find in Isaiah chapter 34 that the prophet is directing certain words against Edom, or Idumea, as it is sometimes called. And in Isaiah chapter 34 and verse 4, he speaks of the judgment that God will pour out upon this nation of Edom, these descendants of Esau. We read there that all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their host shall fall down, as the leaf falleth off from the vine, and as a falling fig from the fig tree. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Idumea, and upon the people of my curse to judgment. The sword of Yahweh is filled with blood. It is made fat with fatness, and with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For Yahweh hath a great sacrifice in Bozrah, and a great slaughter in the land of Idumea. And he goes on to speak in more detail about these judgments that he will pour out upon the heavens of Edom. And where is the nation of Edom today? Well, it has been dissolved, and it has been rolled up together like a scroll. It does not exist. There is no nation of Edom today. They passed out of existence, and the last record we have of any Edomites was at the time of the siege of Jerusalem. You know, the Herods were Edomites, and it was the Edomites in the city of Jerusalem at the time of the Roman siege that in fact caused the majority of the trouble there. Many of the Jews fled, the Edomites tended to stop in the city, and that's the last record that I'm aware of any literal Edomites. Certainly there is no nation of Edom today, and there hasn't been for hundreds of years. It's gone. And it's styled there that the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll. Quickly looking at one or two others, in Ezekiel chapter 32, verses 7 and 8, we've got the Egyptian heavens. Another very prominent nation in the times of the prophets. Ezekiel 32, verse 7. We know this chapter speaking about Egypt because we're told that in verse 2, that it's a lamentation against Egypt. Verse 7 says, "And when I shall put thee out, I will cover the heaven and make the stars thereof dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. All the bright lights of heaven will I make dark over thee, and set darkness upon thy land, saith the Lord Yahweh." Now these judgments have been poured out upon Egypt, but at no stage did this literally happen. It is symbolic, poetic type language. Heavens once again being ruling powers. We've got the Babylonian heavens. In Isaiah chapter 14, we won't look all these up, but you can trace them through. Isaiah chapter 14, verses 4 and 12, speaks of the Babylonian heavens. And that's an interesting chapter because that was the heaven that Lucifer fell out of in that particular chapter. And Lucifer fell down from heaven. He was a king of Babylon, and he was going to be removed from his throne. And so Lucifer, which is a title used of the planet Venus, which is the evening star, or it can be the morning star, depending on what time of the cycle it is. It's the brightest light in the heavens apart from the sun and the moon. And the king of Babylon is likened unto this bright star. He was the brightest star in the heavens, but he was to fall. And so he fell from the Babylonian heavens. And our other two references there, Isaiah 65, verses 17 and 18, and Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 17, speak of the new heavens which Yahweh shall establish. Let's just look at one of those, Isaiah chapter 65, verses 17 and 18. Because this is the one, of course, that we're going to be looking at in the book of Revelation. Isaiah 65, verse 17. "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind." And by way of explanation, he says, "But be ye glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing, and her people a joy. So you see the parallelism there. I create new heavens and a new earth. He says, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing, I create her people a joy. That's the new heavens and that's the new earth. Jerusalem will be the center of the new heavens, and the people will be the new earth. They will be the ones that will be ruled over. And so it is this heavens and earth of the time when God manifestation, when it will see its completion, which is the subject of the apocalypse. Therefore, when we come to Revelation chapter 4, and we read there that a door was opened in heaven, and John was invited to come up and to see things which shall be hereafter, what was he being shown? He was being shown a picture of the new order of things, the new ruling order of things, which shall exist in the kingdom age. That word hereafter is an important word. You see, it may be possible that someone will say to you that I think that this is only speaking about a vision of something that's going on in heaven at the present time. Well, obviously that's not right, for the simple reason that John was told not to come up and see things which are now, but of things which shall be hereafter. And that very little word hereafter, in all its simplicity, tells us quite clearly that it was a vision of something which was to be future to the time of John. And John was going to be in spirit when he experienced these things, because he is here acting the part of a representative man. Now we come then to this voice, which he heard as of a trumpet that was talking with him. We've already made some brief comments about this trumpet back in volume 1, because as we've said, John is telling us here that it's the same trumpet voice that he'd heard previously back in chapter 1 and verse 10. He heard this loud trumpet-like voice when he was in spirit. And since John was enacting the part of a representative person, it's equivalent to saying that when he shall behold the reality of the similitude which he saw in spirit, he will also be in spirit, which likewise intimates by implication that he will have previously risen from the dead and be spirit. You're quite right. I didn't write those words myself, and that's taken direct from Eureka. But it's quite a profound statement, but really it's simple in its essence. It's saying this, that when John says, I was in spirit, he's acting the part of a representative man, and he's saying that in the day when this shall be in reality, I will be spirit. I will be spirit nature. In other words, implying that he will have previously been raised from the dead. John, having referred us to the first voice of the trumpet in chapter 1 verse 10, is now indicating that the first and the second hearing of the same voice relates to the same epoch or point of time. When he first heard that trumpet voice back in chapter 1, he was in spirit on the Lord's day. Now if he hears that same voice again, obviously it's the same day. And he's in spirit, as he tells us here in chapter 4. So you've got two soundings then of this trumpet. The first sounding and the second sounding. They both have relationship to the day of the Lord. They both relate, in fact, to the seventh trumpet period. And as John turned to see in the first instance, and looked and ascended in the second, that is this one here in chapter 4, the vision of the Son of Man and the vision of the thrones, the elders and the living ones, are both representative of those things designed to come to pass after the advent of Christ and the resurrection of the saints. The beginning of the first voice awoke him to life and action, and afterwards the same voice invited him to ascend to the heaven and to inherit the kingdom established there. So you see, as we go through this, we've got to take each point. Every word is important. It's quite easy to come up with a theory in regard to what this chapter's all about and just glibly gloss over things like the trumpet voice. But in fact, this is important. Those who've done a bit of a study of the law will probably find this point quite meaningful. Those who haven't, I'm going to suggest that perhaps you just take the note as it stands and determine that at some future date, be it soon or be it far off, that's up to you, you'll look into this a little deeper. But I don't want to particularly labour this point beyond the note which I've got here in the middle of page 48. So let's take this note as it stands in the middle of page 48, and what I'm going to do now is to draw attention to the two soundings of the trumpet as being based upon the two soundings of the trumpet back in the law. The trumpet to which this loud first voice belongs is that represented in the memorial of the blowing of trumpets on the first day of the seventh month. And you'll find it in Leviticus chapter 23, verse 24. Should be a colon between 23 and 24. It is that sounding by which the princes, the heads of the thousands of Israel, are summoned to gather themselves together unto Christ, the King of Israel. It precedes the sounding on the tenth day of the seventh month, which proclaims liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants. Now what it's saying is that in Leviticus 23 and 25, there were two soundings of this trumpet. The first one gathered the people together, and the second one proclaimed liberty. It was a jubilee. Now, the counterpart is found in this. The saints are first raised and exalted to the heavens. In other words, they meet the Lord in the air, as symbolized in this chapter. And then afterward, the great trumpet of the jubilee is blown by Yahweh Elohim, who in the lightning and thunders which proceed out of the throne, goes forth with the whirlwind of the south. The first voice, then, is the apocalyptic antitype of the Mosaic ordinance of the memorial of the blowing of the two silver trumpets, which were blown for the calling of the assembly, a holy convocation, and for the journeying of the camps. It is heard by the class of which John is the apocalyptic representative, and who are invited to ascend hither. So as I said, without doing a detailed study of the significance of the trumpets under the law, there was the two soundings. You've got the two soundings here. The first one gathered the people together, and that, after all, is the basic summary of chapters 1 to 3 of Revelation. And the next one proclaims liberty. And this is what John's got. He's going to ascend hither. He's going to be raised from the dead, and he's going to be in spirit, symbolized by this second blowing of the trumpet. So we leave that note for each one to take as deep as they like. Well, let's move on then to our next phrase, where John is told to come up, or rather to ascend hither. And I will show thee things which must come to pass after these things. This word ascend here is the key word. It's rendered come up in the authorized version, but Brother Thomas translates it as to ascend. And we comment on this because the resurrection of the saints will be followed by their ascension. Now, it's very easy, isn't it, for a person to come in halfway through this story and say, what are you talking about, going to heaven? Well, no, we're not talking about going to heaven in a literal sense, but in the symbology of Revelation, yes, we're ascending to heaven. What heaven? Ah, well, it's the kingdom age. It's the ruling system of the new age. And when we are called upon to enter in to be kings and priests in the kingdom age, then in the symbology of Revelation we are ascending into the heavens. It's as simple as that. And so John is acting the part of a representative man who's now being called. John, come up here and I'll show you what it's going to be like hereafter. And I'm going to put it all in sign and in symbol so that only my friends will understand. That's why it is. So obviously his enemies come along and say, oh, we're going to go to heaven. But that's not what he's saying at all. What he's saying is, we're going to go to heaven. But we know how to interpret it, because the symbols tell us that it's an ascension into the political heavens. So the resurrection of the saints will be followed by their ascension. That is, they will be raised from mortality to immortality. I think we'll have a look back at our quote from 1 Corinthians 15, verses 52 and 53. And whilst we might assume that most people would be familiar with this, maybe some of our younger ones wouldn't, so let's not take anything for granted. You know, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the chapter deals with the subject of resurrection. But Paul uses two different words in this chapter. He uses the word resurrection, such as you have in verse 42, in the first line. And he also uses the word raised, such as he has in verse 42 in the second to last line. There is a distinction between resurrection and raising. Whilst in English we may use the word somewhat interchangeably, there is in fact a distinction. So that when we come to verses 52 and 53, and we read there that it will happen in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible. He's not saying that the dead shall be resurrected incorruptible. He's saying the dead shall be raised incorruptible. The raising indicates a raising from mortality to immortality, a raising in status, an ascension, if you like, an ascension from one level to another. But it's not the resurrection. The dead will not be resurrected incorruptible. They will come forth from the grave corruptible. They will come forth with an earthy body. But having come forth and be judged, they will then be raised. So the raising, or as it is sometimes styled, the ascension, and the Lord himself used that term, as we'll see in a moment, the ascension is something which takes place after the resurrection. So that's why we said that when John is told to ascend up hither, it implies that he has been previously resurrected. Which, of course, is part and parcel of this vision, that it's a vision of the kingdom age. John says, I'm in spirit, I'm told to ascend up hither. It therefore implies that he must first have been resurrected. The vision is clearly a vision of the kingdom age. In regard to this use of the term ascension, we find it used by the Lord himself in John chapter 20, when he speaks to Mary, who came down to the tomb and saw him, and he commanded her to touch him not. For he says in John chapter 20 and verse 17, touch me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brethren and say unto them, I ascend unto my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God. Now John, who's recording this, and this is typical of John's style of writing, is also the one who records the Apocalypse. There are many very similar figures of speech in both books, as a matter of fact, both the Gospel and in the book of Revelation. So as we say, this is illustrated in the case of the Lord Jesus, who first came out of the sepulchre, and then after a certain interval, ascended to the Father. An ascent not to be confused with that event which took place 40 days later, described in Acts chapter 1, verses 10 and 11. He ascended to the Father before he was taken up. It was necessary that he should be in spirit, and so become spirit, that he might be with the Father. So the Lord Jesus Christ ascended from the grave with an earthy body. He later ascended, or was raised, incorruptible, and then sometime later, he was taken up into heaven. So his ascension, or his raising, indicated the change from corruptibility to incorruptibility, from an earthy body to a heavenly body. And these are the terms which we find in passages like 1 Corinthians 15. And so, although John looked and heard, he saw nothing until after the invitation to ascend, with the promise that subsequent to his ascension, he should see an exhibition of things which should come to pass when the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom, to coin a phrase from Daniel 7:22, which implies their resurrection and ascent after the similitude of the resurrection and ascension dramatized by John in type. The invitation to John to ascend into the heaven was equivalent to inviting him to meet the Lord in the air, to coin a phrase from 1 Thessalonians 4:17. And by implication, an invitation to all whom he represented to do so likewise at the appointed time. Well, that's Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1. It's laying a basis for symbols which are going to come in later on. And if we were to summarise it, but of course in so doing we tend to take all the beauty out of it, we would say this, that John is now invited to look into the future, and to see what it's going to be like in the kingdom, and to be able to look back and to see all of those events which are going to lead up to the establishment of the kingdom. But of course John is being told that if he's really going to experience this in reality, then of course he will have to be resurrected. He will have to ascend. He will have to be in spirit. And therefore that's all that chapter 4 verse 1 is about. Well, he continues on in verse 2 and says, and immediately I was in spirit, and behold, a throne was set in heaven, and one sat on the throne. This verse is fairly straightforward, having laid the basis in verse 1. This is the logical extension of it. But notice he says, immediately, I was in the Spirit. So he's going to immediately see things which shall be hereafter. It's not as though the things which shall be hereafter don't start till chapter 5. The things which shall be hereafter start straight away. And he's going to see immediately these things. He's not going to talk about present things right down to the end of chapter 4, and then by the time he gets to chapter 5 start to look into the future. He's looking at the future immediately, because he was in spirit on the Lord's day when this trumpet blew.